know, I came here to speak about the rights of nature. The rights of the river were recognized in Aotearoa, the Klamath River. The rights of mountains have been recognized in the Ecuadorian constitutional law. And a few years ago, corporations tried to get into some of that territory. The Ecuadorian Supreme Court ruled the rights of nature superseded the rights of corporations.
That's Winona LaDuke, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamian. This edition of AR features Winona LaDuke on rights of nature, an indigenous view. Indigenous peoples often see themselves as an integral part of nature, not separate from it, and recognize the interconnectedness of all living beings and nature. Indigenous perspectives on the rights of nature emphasize a deep spiritual bond with the natural world, viewing it as a sacred entity and an essential part of their cultural and social fabric. Many indigenous cultures believe that nature has inherent rights and that humans have responsibilities to respect, protect, and maintain the health of the environment for the well-being of future generations. Indigenous communities are increasingly in the forefront of the rights of nature movement, working to incorporate their values and beliefs into legal frameworks and policies. Our guest today is Winona LaDuke, an elder Anishinaabe. She's a brilliant and articulate representative of indigenous perspectives. At the age of 17, she spoke at the United Nations on behalf of Native Americans. She's a founding member of Women of All Red Nations, and for many years she was the director of the Land Recovery Project on the White Earth Reservation in Minnesota. She was the 1996 and 2000 vice presidential candidate of the Green Party. She's the author of many books, including To Be a Water Protector. She spoke at the University of Oregon in Eugene in March 2025. And now, Winona LaDuke.
Anin Nindoe Maganado Kaloma, relatives. So nice to see you all out there. So again, thank you so much for inviting me here. It's heartwarming to see all of you and to think about that these are the times that we must really work together. And this is an opportunity to do that. And so I'm honored to be here to join with you in that. As I said, Anin Indinawe Muganatuk, that means hello my relatives. Indunjaba Oma'aking, that means I come from this land. But Aking means the land to which, the very land to which the people belong. It's not like private property. Aking, it means the land to which the people belong. That's kind of a different way of thinking, huh? And then there's Indaking Amin, that means the very land to which I belong. And I think that that is what we must all take into our hearts, that we belong to this land. We belong to these rivers. We belong to this place, and in that there is this reciprocal relationship where we take care and we give love, and she takes care of us. So that is always what we must reaffirm, because we live in a world that does not reaffirm that relationship. And so it is upon us individually and collectively to reaffirm. So as I was speaking, thinking to speak tonight, I wanted to put my friend Ingrid Washington-Watak up. This is the 25th anniversary of her assassination. She was assassinated in Colombia by the FARC 25 years ago, an indigenous leader from Menominee. And she was a good sister of mine. She was a co-chair of the Indigenous Women's Network for about a decade and did really amazing international work. She was courageous and bold and funny and just one of the most beautiful people that you would ever know. And I think about, you know, as I get older, because I have really more winters behind me than ahead of me. You know, I'm 65 years of age. And as I note that, and as I see my sister goes, Or maybe another sister goes, and then I see some of my brothers come home. Did you see that Leonard Peltier came home? Right. My whole life. I just take a moment and say, that was a great thing. You know, Joe, you were kind of a chump sometimes, but that was a good one, huh? Man, I didn't know that was going to happen in my life. You know, in my life and in all of our lives, we carry like a basket. That's how I think of it, a basket of our cool things that we cherish. You know, it's not our will, it's our cool work. It's our spirit, the things that we cherish, the things that we value. And I think about when someone passes, there is this basket. And the things that are in the basket should be distributed so we all carry on. You understand what I'm saying? And so I've been thinking about this a lot. You know, not only as I get older, but also as I think about what it is that we do to keep intergenerational or just to keep our knowledge, our teachings, our visions to continue. And that is what is this basket. You know, I'm from northern Minnesota, is where I live now, not at home with my mother in Ashland, although very nice Ashland, very nice Oregon. But there is snow at home. There's no daffodils, right? There's no rhododendrons getting ready to pop. It is snow. And in that, though, each spring we know that it is a new beginning that can come. And that is part of what is the gift of our Mother Earth and the creation, is that you know that it's a cyclical life. And you have a new opportunity each spring to do something beautiful. That it is a time of rebirth. And coming out of the quiet times of now, or the times when we prepare, just remember that a new time is coming, and it is our opportunity, because we are the ones who are here to make this new time that is ahead of us. Gawawiegamug, I live on the White Earth Reservation in northern Minnesota. I spend most of my time there, and then I wander some, although I have not wandered as much over the past years as many of you. You've also stayed home. That's why I was like, I've not been to Eugene in a very long time. And I'm a wild rice harvester. I'm a farmer. And I live in a place, I live where the wild things are. Because that is true. On a worldwide scale, 75% of the world's biodiversity is in indigenous territories, right? 4% of the world's population, 75% of the biodiversity. A lot of the agrobiodiversity too. And so, you know, as we look at the time ahead, we must take care of where the wild things are. Because that is where there is life. That is where there is spirit. That is where our relationship is always reaffirmed. And so I spend a lot of time fighting for the places where the wild things are, you know, as we all must. But it also fills our souls and our hearts when we see those beautiful things, you know, those beautiful parts of creation. Let us talk about making America great again. And this is my idea of when America was great. America was great when there were 50 million buffalo. That's when America was great, when there were 50 million buffalo. Single largest migratory herd in the world, living on 250 different species of grass, and the largest biome in North America, the Northern Plains, or the Plains, right? That's when America was great. There are still 800 varieties of potatoes, not bad. Now, why would you eat those Idaho spuds when you could eat something that looks that cool, right? These are pictures for the Potato Museum in Peru, right? And America was great when there were 10,000 varieties of corn. That's when America was great, when you could drink the water from every stream and river, and life was all around us. That's when America was great. So don't forget that greatness. You know, Americans have a lot of, I think it's historical amnesia, but also we have ecological amnesia, where we forget what was there, where we forget what is there. And part of what our opportunity is to remember what was there. And sometimes we can bring that back. You know, I've seen it in my lifetime. I've seen the sturgeon come back in my rivers in northern Minnesota, and I've seen dams go down, right? I can see how we can bring back the greatness of America. And I know that you know that we are all in the same canoe, the same Gmon. You know, I was an undergraduate at Harvard, and as an undergraduate at Harvard, when you wanted to go to the see the art of Europe, you went to the fine arts department, and when you wanted to see indigenous art, you went to anthropology and the Peabody Museum, which is actually where I worked as an undergraduate. And so I say that because I just want us to think about the value system that says that European art is in the fine arts department and art of people of color is not in the same department. You know, and part of what this moment is, which is a moment that is in not only the time of prophecies, which is where we are, but it is the moment of absolute change, chaos, right? Crisis and opportunity. It is the year of the snake, I was told by the Chinese. Y'all follow that one? I was like, oh, that sounds horrible. They said, no, shed your skin. That's what my Chinese sister told me. She said, shed your skin. Make something new. So we are all in the same canoe. That's what we all are. And in that time that we're in the canoe, maybe it is a good time to shed some extra colonial baggage and such. Shed some things that we don't need. Drop them. Because it is time to, as Arundhati Roy would say, it's a portal. So she talked about the pandemic as a portal between one world and the next. That's what she said. It's a portal. Pandemics always cause crisis. And in that moment, it's a portal between one world and the next. And you got to decide what you're going to bring through the portal. You're going to bring your, she says, you're going to bring your dirty rivers. You're going to bring your nasty data banks. You're going to bring all your bags. Are you going to walk through clean? You know, so think about this spring as this time when we say what it is we are going to be. And remember that that is our power. So I want to talk about some of the prophecies that I have heard in my life. You know, I'm older now. I got to hear a lot of those cool people talk in my younger days, and I listened. You know, we didn't know some of what they were saying, right? Thomas Banyaka, a great Hopi elder. He used to talk about this time in the world where there would be two paths ahead. It's not unlike the Ojibwe story of the choice between, in the time of the seventh fire, between two paths. It is said that we have a choice between one path that is well-worn but scorched, or a path that is not well-worn but it is green. It would be our choice upon which path to embark. And that's what our prophets told us so long ago as Anishinaabe people. We were told that. But I don't think that that's just us. I think we all have that choice. You got to choose a path. You got to choose a path. Thomas was saying that too. And so he has these two paths that he would explain to us, and he would say we would have two paths as humans upon which to travel. And one path stays with the earth. You can see that path, right? And then the other path that goes up in the sky. And I think that that is the Elon Musk path. That's what I think. You know, I'm not absolutely sure, but that looks like the Elon Musk path, right? And I'm saying, stay here, okay? Those guys, one-way trip, go to Mars, that's awesome. Head out. We stay here, right? So that's what he was saying, you know? And those guys said a lot of other cool stuff. They talked about this web in the sky. And I remember being a young woman, like in the 80s, and listening to Thomas. And they would talk about this time that there would be a spider web in the sky. And that would signify a change in the worlds, right? And in the 1970s and 80s, we didn't know what a spider web in the sky was. We were like, what is that? You know, that sounds like a military thing. I was like, I don't know what he's talking about. But here we are in the time of the World Wide Web. Here we are in the time of Stargate. Here we are in the time of 5G. Here we are in the time when the energy consumed by Bitcoin mining and Google is exceeding the energy produced or consumed by many countries. We are in a time when this world that exists with the tech dudes is an entirely different world. And that is the time that they talked of as the time of prophecies. My father, his name was Vincent LeDuc or Sun Bear. And he used to also say many things too. He used to tell me different things, and some of you knew him. He used to talk about that there will be a time. Well, he used to say to me first, I always tell this story, that he came to see me one day at Harvard. And you know, he had about eighth grade education, but he was a very intelligent man, anybody who knew him. And he had a special calling. And he came to see me one day at Harvard, and he said, Winona, you're a smart young woman, but I don't want to hear your philosophy if you can't grow corn. But he was right. You know, you could be super smart, but if you can't grow anything, you know, where are you at? You know, and I don't want to say that that is happening, but we have a lot of people that are not very connected. But that's what he was saying. And so I worked very hard to be a corn grower. I want you to know that. But he used to also say that there would be a time when there was no food in the store. And I remember that, and you remember that too, because we just went through that. That was the time of COVID, when they dropped all that food, destroyed all that food, buried all that food. And that was in the moment that perhaps we realized that food security would probably not occur on a ship, on a train, or a truck. That is the time that we remembered that we should grow our food. And, you know, and he was right. And that time is certainly this time of now. I have not been here for a long time. I was trying to remember, but I remember talking with Lane County, the Rights of Nature group, at a church. And at the time I was at the church, I had left Standing Rock, and I had come here, and this is what occurred on Backwater Bridge. There was this full-on assault, $38 million worth of military equipment. A lot of people hurt. A lot of people hurt. A lot of special forces came out, all for the purpose of late-stage fossil fuel addiction, right? This is what addicts do. The problem is being an addict, you make a lot of bad decisions, and you do a lot of bad stuff. And I bet everybody in this room has some experience with an addict, right? Because I know that and I've seen it. But that's what this society does, right? And so we're at a point where the addiction level is so high that we just rampage, destroy things, hurt a lot of people for the greed of fossil fuel corporations and oil companies. This is in more pictures from Standing Rock. I was at a trial there in March. I was a federal witness. In the trial of North Dakota versus the United States, where the state of North Dakota was trying to get somebody to pay the $38 million that they spent, and they wanted the United States to pay for it. And so the U.S. called me up one day. It's a funny thing to say. The U.S. attorney called me up one day and said, Winona, would you consider being a witness for the United States? To which, you know, first when the U.S. attorney calls you, you gulp. Does that make sense? You're all like, yeah. And what can I help you with? That's kind of how that conversation went. And the guy says, could you consider being a witness for the United States? I said, probably not. I mean, you know, why would I be? You know what I'm saying? This doesn't sound like something that you're going to want to do, right? And he says, well, how about if there's this case in North Dakota where the state of North Dakota is trying to sue the United States because they issued a conditional use permit for what was a floodplain, and y'all came out there. And now the state of North Dakota says that the United States is responsible for Standing Rock because they issued a permit. So let me ask you a question, Ms. LaDuke. Did you go to Standing Rock because the Army Corps of Engineers issued a permit? I said, no. I said, I went because I'm a water protector, right? That's how we all went. I went because the Lakota people asked me to go. I went because we had defeated a pipeline known as the Sandpiper, an Enbridge pipeline destined to bring fracked oil across our territory. And instead of doing the pipeline across our territory after we defeated them, Enbridge financed 28% of the Dakota Access Pipeline. So I went because of that. You know, so Standing Rock doesn't end. The state of North Dakota has been prosecuting water protectors 800 for years, and now is trying to see if they can destroy Greenpeace. And so there's a jury trial in Morton County that they're at. And they say Greenpeace is actually responsible for Standing Rock. At first it was the U.S. and now it's Greenpeace. But as far as I know, we were all responsible for Standing Rock, right? I was like, I was there. That's right. I was there. Nobody told me. Nobody from Greenpeace told me what to do. Nobody from the Army Corps of Engineers told me what to do. I went. Because the creator said, go on out there, girl. Right? So anyway, it's nice. I'm going to bring this love with me to Mandan. Can I do that? Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. Bring my love to the deep north. That's what we call North Dakota, the deep north. I'll bring the love back. So this is what else I was doing past little while. After that, they did line three. We tried everything to stop that pipeline, did not. Did a lot of standing like this, standing in front of a lot of equipment. I bet a lot of you have done the same thing, right? Sit in front of a lot of equipment and then faced a lot of arrests. I was one of seven women arrested sitting in those chairs for hours, hours. I learned a little trick. I learned it earlier in my movement history, and the trick is to wear Depends. Just passing that one on in case you need it at some point in time. You know, but I didn't actually use it. I don't want to share that with you, except for that it was a complete drought. And so I just sat there for like 4 hours singing with my sisters. And then at a certain point, it poured for the first time in a month and a half. It poured. And we were so grateful. And that's when the cops decided to arrest us because it was raining, right? Sounds about right. But you know what happens when you're wearing a Depends in a downpour? Y'all got me on that one, right? I was like walking into jail, hiking up my Depends, which is like now disintegrating on my way to the jail cell. And they were like looking at me. I was like, sorry, not really, but sorry, you know. Anyway, I'm just passing on some movement history. Anyway, bad things have happened to Fort McMurray. And then this is the latest thing that happened. What is this? Are they going to try to start Trojan again? I mean, what the hell, right? You know, didn't we fight these guys off because it was a bad idea 40 years ago? It's still a really bad idea. You know, and this is all for what? Google, Microsoft, and Bitcoin mining, right? Yeah, that's some crazy. Should we just say that one more time? I was like, yeah, it was bad then, it's really bad now. And so this is kind of their agenda, and this is things that we must step up for because we happen to be the people who are here. You know, look around, there's like, we're the ones. We are people who are living in the time of prophecies. And so that is a great, great moment to be in. So keep that in your hearts as you stand up, you muster up the courage, you have thinking prayers, and we work together to challenge bad ideas, because that's what we do. Spend a whole life fighting bad ideas. And sometimes you win. If you do not fight, you do not win. That's how that works. I saw that we won on Jordan Cove, didn't we? That is right, you know. And I was just out on the Mole Lake Reservation in Wisconsin, and I had to go look at the mine site that that tribe bought. They bought the mine site after BHP Billiton and Rio Tinto Zinc and Kennecott and Exxon tried to mine. The tribe just one day, they just bought that damn mine site. $26 million it cost them. But you know what? No mine. No mine. So just remember, that's how it works. You got to figure out the strategy, and there is no one strategy. There's many, and we all have our part. But okay, so what else I've been doing? Well, this is what happened to me in the pandemic. I just want to say, I moved to the farm, began to be a corn grower. No, I was a corn grower before, and this is in the height of the pandemic. What happened is that a bunch of mostly grandsons, nephews, other people's sons and grandsons moved in with me. They're like, we don't have school, but you got horses. I was like, yeah, let's do this. It's not even in light of the present situation. But you know, I got more belief in those kids than my Social Security and 401k. You know what I'm saying? Who is caring for and teaching and training those who will come behind us to care for this land? You know, that is your retirement plan, those guys, right? A lot of you are my retirement plan too. You know, that is what we must do. We must always teach each other, you know, and teach those that are still coming how, what it is we can do. So let me talk about some things that I think we need to do and where we are going. And I like to call this the Sitting Bull Plan. And I do that because, you know, they name all those big plans after white guys, like the Marshall Plan. You know what I mean? The guy named it after someone. So I think Sitting Bull is your guy. You know, I am not a hunk papa, but he was a great political leader. He was a spiritual leader. He lived with his people. He led many great and profound victories in many levels. But he said many things, and one of the things he said is, let us put our minds together to see what kind of future we can make for our children. And I repeat that because the truth is that there is nobody going to save us. We all figured out Elon is not saving anybody. There is no techno fix for what is going down. There is no social change fairy. There is no carbon sequestration fairy. This is something that takes all of us to make these changes, to make that which is beautiful. And so let us talk about how some of those changes look. Now, this is some beautiful young women who are caretakers on the Klamath River. They had their prayers and their songs and their ceremonies. And I say that because that, you know, reaffirms relationship to place. In docking them in the very land to which you belong, it reaffirms relationship through song, you know, and through ceremony. And humans can do that. You know, don't forget that we are beautiful. A lot of us feel kind of like jerks, ecological jerks, right? But remember that we can be beautiful and we must be our better selves. We must be our best selves. And in that, this is where you see these kind of women who are caretakers of the Klamath. And then you see that when their prayers come true, the dams come down, right? The dams come down, and when the dams come down, life can return. You know, a lot of us never thought we would see that. I was reading one of the great Yurok writers, and she was talking about how she thought her generation was going to witness the death of the river. And instead, she gets to witness the rebirth of the river. So do not give up hope or prayers, and do not give up or back down and work. Because it takes a long time to bring about these changes. And we must keep the memory of the movement. We must keep the memory of the stories. We must keep the memory of the animals. We must keep the memories. And that is how we make the change. And then you see it. So we see this change in many places, you know. I am privileged. I am so privileged. You know, I got a great mom, but also in my life, I have been able to visit many of our communities, you know, and I just like this buffalo pin peekaboo, basically, but yeah. We could say it's at Yellowstone, he's looking at a tourist, but without the Rangers, we're kind of wondering how that's going to work out. It could be really fun this year, huh? Nobody to tell him to quit, you know? It's like unbelievable, the things that go on out there. Oh my God, it does entertain. It is a little dangerous, but it is kind of entertaining sometimes. All right. You know, single largest migratory herd in the world and decimated. But now you see the beginning of their return. So you see that like 40 tribes have brought back the buffalo, right? Like I work at a treaty rights museum in Minnesota called Gewaydenong. A treaty that we talk about there is the Buffalo Treaty. These are the new treaties. This is a treaty made of cooperation to bring home the buffalo. And this is how you do it. You make agreements to bring back the herds. You trade your genetics to make sure that everything is good in the herd. And you set up the land for the herds. And then you know what the thing is that when you bring back the buffalo, then the buffalo bring back the plants. And they bring back the birds, and they bring back the water, and they bring back the soil. And so that's why you bring back the buffalo. It's because the old thing is the thing that heals it. It's not the new thing. It's the old thing that's supposed to be there. And in that greatness, you know, that is how our responsibility and relationship is restored, because we do our job. Our part as humans, our part of the covenant, our part of the agreement.
You're listening to Winona LaDuke, Rights of Nature, An Indigenous View. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online our website, alternativeradio.org.
And so I'm really interested in post-petroleum agriculture, right? post-petroleum agriculture. And so I think we should all kind of be into that one, right? And actually, so a lot of my work is with pre- and post-petroleum agriculture. So I have farmed for many years, 30 years so, and I raise heritage corn varieties, beans, squash, potatoes, Jerusalem artichokes, tobacco, and then all kind of things like I like eggplant too. My point would be is that a lot of those seeds are, they're smart. Like that corn that that girl is holding, that is a Mandan variety. I grew it on my field. I grew it because it's a drought-resistant variety. And I grew that in the year that they had a drought, that same year that I got arrested in a war that depends. It was 2021. I grew this corn. Montano varieties did not hold, but my varieties did. My corn held because heritage varieties are smart. They have a brain and they're intelligent. They aren't created by Monsanto. And so in the times of climate change, what we need to grow is the heritage varieties, because they're the varieties that can adapt, and they're the ones that are smart, and they're the ones that didn't need petroleum and don't need it now. So remember that as spring comes, and I know that Eugene is full of such cool plants. This is what I do. I grow hemp. We bought out these guys called RDO Offit, single large potato farmers, really evil potato farmers as it is, and they contaminate this land, and hemp is really amazing crop. I grow textile hemp. My main work is in fiber hemp varieties. And so I've been growing varieties, and you know, we grew varieties from China, from France, from Spain, from the Czech Republic, from Romania. And then I really like to grow the feral varieties. So that's what I've been working on with the University of Minnesota, because it turns out that that ditchweed, that's what we're talking about. They try to eradicate hemp, and so it's been illegal for like 80 years, right? But some of it is hanging on. And like all kind of cool places, a lot of them around some of our native reservations where the wild things are. And there you find these feral varieties of hemp. And I figure anything that grew illegally for 80 years is very tough. You following me on this? This is what you want, right? And so I'm working with the University of Minnesota because my stepfather worked at the Oregon State University at the Agricultural Extension. And so I was raised around guys who did plant varieties. And so what I'm interested in is building a gene, building the seed stock for the new green revolution. And that's the hemp revolution. That's the hemp revolution. But you got to have the seeds for the revolution. And you can't just have a few marijuana seeds. That's not going to do you. You need hundreds of thousands of pounds of seeds. So think of it this way, about 4 acres of hemp will get you a house. Do you guys hear that? And you could grow it and put your house up in the same year, and you can sequester more carbon with that than any other field crop, and you can have a house that is carbon negative, and you can do it in a year, and you can actually save a forest. Y'all follow me on this one? So that's what we're after. And so I'm organizing this cooperative, you know, and Oregon is like way too uptight about this because everybody got into marijuana. And what you guys need to do is you need to get into hemp. That's what you need to do, because that's going to save your forests. That's going to save your forests, and that's going to bioremediate what is going on out there. And you're going to be able to make paper, and you're going to be able to make houses, and you're going to be able to make houses that don't burn. That's why you want to grow hemp. So, 2 years ago, 2023, Patagonia did a bag with us. That's my hemp from my field. And that hemp went to, isn't that cool? That's very cool, isn't it? Okay, so that hemp went to, just to tell you my story, that hemp went from my reservation to North Carolina to get decorticated. Then it went to Virginia to get degummed. Then it went to Mexico to get spun. Then it went to Washington State to get woven. And then it went to California to get cut and sewn so that we could bring you a bag that looks like this. That's awesome, huh? Now, the only problem is that that's what happens when you deconstruct a textile industry, right? And we used to make all that stuff here. And that's what we need to do again, right? That's what how you do it. And so that is my next bit of work. It's going to take me a few years here, but there's a lot of us working on it. And this is my next round of hemp. This is my hemp that went to, our hemp that went to and got spun at Battenkill Fibers, Battencourt Fibers. And then this is a couple of my sons and a hempcrete house at Lower Sioux with a solar thermal panel on it that my guys put in. And that, I think, is the house of the future. And that's to say solar thermal reduces your heating bill by about 30%. Solar takes heat and light, turns it into energy, and then maybe you turn it back into energy or light. But solar thermal just gets hot and goes directly into the house. When it gets around 90 degrees, a fan goes on, thermostat kicks off, fan goes on, puts warm air in the house. So what you want to do is figure out how to consume less, right? And that's what we all got to do. We all got to figure out how to live a little lighter on Mother Earth. And y'all know that because you're here in Eugene, which is where cool people ride bikes. But my point would be, this is the housing of the future. That's my point. This is my house edition, with one of my girlfriends in it. And that is hemp panels that were put together in Bismarck. Hempcrete panels, 6 foot wide, hauled out there on a semi, the walls put up in 4 hours. That's the housing for the future, especially for a lot of tribal communities that need thousands of homes and have no trees. So I'm working on the Northern Plains organizing. Do you like my campaign title, Let My People Grow? It's very biblical and all. Anyway, this is what we're working on because hemp is still like dastardly, dangerous crop, which is ridiculous. If you really wanted to smoke my field, you're a complete idiot. So what is the lesson in this, you know? I'm just saying I come from a community that nobody would bet on. Is that fair? You know, everybody would say, no, wipe those Indians off. I ain't going to amount to much. And then, you know, one day you look out there and you say, well, I guess no one's going to fix that one for us, huh? And so then we just go and start fixing it ourselves. I guess that's part of what I'm saying. You know, this is what it is to have agency. This is what it is to take your power. This is what it is to, you know, to genius a wabandaming, make that beautiful future, make that dream and make that beautiful future that you believe. And so we do that together. And we do that in community. We do that in our gardens. We do that in our housing. We do that as we teach our children. I mean, in the show of Washington, take your power back. Because it is ours. It is not theirs. It is our power. And, you know, as we move ahead in our work, you know, I came here to speak about the rights of nature. And what I want to say is that, you know, we declared the rights of wild rice in our territory in northern Minnesota. The rights of the river were recognized in Aotearoa, the Klamath River. The rights of mountains have been recognized. And in Ecuador, they enshrine the rights of nature in the Ecuadorian constitutional law. And a few years ago, corporations tried to get into some of the territory. The Ecuadorian Supreme Court, I think in 2022, ruled that the rights of nature superseded the rights of corporations. And, you know, that is really kind of, that's post-colonial law, isn't it? And that's kind of where we need to be going. You know, because what those old people always told us is that the Creator's law is the highest law. Higher than the laws made by nations, states, or municipalities, and one would do well to live in accordance with the Creator's law. And in our jurisprudence systems and in our covenant, reaffirmation of our covenant, the rights of nature is how we reaffirm that in law. As I close out this wonderful time I have with you and we open for some questions or we have some discussion, and I give you my love for being here today. It is so heartwarming to see all of you. Then just remember, you know, that it is spring that is coming. You know, this is a Zapatista saying or a Mexican saying. They tried to bury us. They didn't know we were seeds. And so that is really us. Be the seeds. Be the seeds. Be the seeds of whether it is the seeds of the food or the seeds of the ideas, the seeds of the heart. You know, be those seeds. And distribute and germinate them widely. Because spring is coming. And we will need to be those people who share our seeds. Because that is how change is made. And that is how summer comes and food comes to our tables and dreams come to our hearts. So Miigwech, thank you for your time. And I really appreciate y'all. Miigwech.
So we are very grateful that you're here, Winona. So we have some questions we quickly made for you. The first one being, you've been really deeply involved in resisting pipelines and extractive industries. How do you stay resilient in the face of corporate and governmental pushback?
Well, I come from tough people. You know, all of our ancestors had to make struggles. Some of us shoulder different things. We all carry different things. So just, you know, I don't want to say chin up, buttercup. Sometimes I say that, though. I'm just like, come on, let's go, girls. And then you reaffirm things with life. You know, you fight the bad guys, but then go do your ceremony, go do your dance, you know, bring your joy to things, you know, because they're all ugly. You know, their behavior is ugly. They didn't even have good music. You know what I'm saying? Like, I remember that in the pipeline battle, we would show up and we'd be like all dressed fabulously, right? And they'd be like in their like khakis, all uptight, jerk stuff, you know? I was like, they don't got no dance moves, they got nothing. So just remember, we got that, you know? So keep it and do it, you know?
As Indigenous students, you know, we're trying to balance the two worlds of academia and holding on to our cultural traditions. And what is some advice you have for Indigenous students trying to balance both of these worlds?
So my special trick is that I wrote most of my papers at Harvard on struggles. That was my special trick. I decided, like, if you got a Harvard education, first of all, someone's paying for that. So you better make sure that you get what you want out of it. And so it's really important that you're accountable for the gift that you have. And so I wrote a lot of stuff like that. And then, you know, I'm not very competitive, it turns out. I just like, I hope the creator thinks I did a good job. You know, so that's it. You know, just do your best. And then see, you know, like in this balance, and you could find it, you know, and then cut yourself a little slack. You got this chance at this college or this university, and, you know, you guys get to learn, you get classes I never would have had when I was, like, back in the day. I want to go to school here. I mean, you know what I mean? It's like they got cool classes, so just go take some cool-ass class about something you never knew nothing about. Just because that's cool, that's great too, you know?
What gives you hope for the future of Indigenous-led movements for environmental justice? How can Indigenous youth be more involved?
Did you see those pictures of my grandchildren? There you go. That's what you do. You bring them. You take them. I mean, they were camping at Standing Rock. Like, we all lived in different times. You know, I am someone, I was reflecting, I was writing an article on my mother and, you know, and how she influenced my work as a community organizer. And so I think about it, and I was, you know, not to go through the whole story, but like, community organizing is not a science. It's not like you get this many people sign petition, you show up this place. You understand what I'm saying? It's an art. It's so many things, it's a living being. You know, so many things are happening. And you need to be like on that, you know, in that moment. And so I was raised, you know, I watched Walter Cronkite every night announce the body count in Vietnam. I remember that. That left a mark on me. You know, my mother took me to demonstrations. I watched them crack egg on a guy's head in front of the courthouse in Medford, that old redneck town. You know, I watched that. I lived that. And so I saw people who stood in very challenging situations. You know, I was just in Greensboro. where I went to the Museum of Civil Rights and Human Rights, and they bought the dang Woolworth store and turned it into a museum where they had the sit-in, right? And so now we go there and you get to learn about that. And we bought, the former Enbridge office in Park Rapids, Minnesota. They leave town, we buy their office, turned it into a museum. Did I say that? Yeah, right. Because we wanted to tell our story, called Giwaydong Museum. That's where I work part-time, curator. But my point would be that you raise your children well and believe in them. You know, someone believed in us, right? Someone believed in us. And so I just do my best for that, you know, and then do as much as we can in our part to pass on as much goodness to them. And that also means take some arrests for your kids. I had charges in 4 counties a couple years ago. I have no jail this year. But the year is young. You know, take some charges for those young people. Take some charges for them. You know, that's what I would say. Because they're going to have a hard time. They're going to have knocks. They're going to take knocks, you know. And so I think about that, you know, and I think about how shameful it is to arrest elder women, too. But I was like, bring it on, guys. You're going to arrest us all? Go ahead. You know, but then just do your best for them and you know, teach them as much as you can. That's what I would say, you know.
So having run for public office, what was your biggest takeaway, and do you think there can be political changes in the government?
Kind of looking like some tough sledding for a little while, but hang on. You know, and then, I mean, I think that there's some lessons. We don't want to go through the whole process right now, but we ought to get our act together, right? Y'all got that. Like, I am someone who has tried everything to make change. I've been arrested. I've been to the United Nations. I've been to Congress. I've run for national office, signed every petition. I been at every hearing, provided all the testimony. You got to do everything. Some of us have more, you know, of a stomach, we'll call it that, you know, or a gift for some things than others. Find your gift. Do your part, you know, whatever it is, because we all want to have, like, allies that are there, right? Allies that are in. So I believe in change in those offices, you know. I can't wait till Deb Haaland is the governor of New Mexico, right? And, you know, and then just look at, my God, look at Claudia in Mexico, huh? Y'all been watching her, the president of Mexico? I was like, go Mexico, right? So, you know, change happens in many ways. So just support that change and find your part.
I'm understanding that we're all here because we have a connection with the land. We all have a connection with the books that you have written. And so a question I have is, how do you balance your well-being as an indigenous environmental activist? You know, you're not just an environmental activist, you're an indigenous one. And that takes a lot of well-being, your mental well-being, your spiritual well-being. And I just want to know, as an indigenous student doing similar work, it's tiring. And sometimes it's just so hard to pick yourself up out of bed and go to school or do all of this work. And I want to know how you keep yourself balanced.
You know, when I was a student at Harvard, there was this guy named Masilo Mabeda, and he was a South African national who was a political refugee. He was a member of the African National Congress, right? The same party of Nelson Mandela. His name was Masilo Mabeda, and he and I were students together. He was a graduate student, and I was an undergraduate student. And one day we were sitting there in Adam's house, and we had this pile of books, and we were having some deep political discussion about the ANC and the American Indian Movement or something cool like that, right? And this one guy comes in. You know, this is Harvard. This is called the Gold Coast, this house that I lived in, Adam's house. And this guy comes in, and he says, Masilo, why do you work so hard? That's what he said to Masilo. And you know what Masilo said to him? He said, because you refuse to work. That is it. That is a part of it. It's like, we should not be doing all the work for all the students here. We should not be doing all the work for everybody. Everybody needs to do the work, right? Don't put it on all the Native students to do all the work, right? Don't do that, you know, because we're busy. We got stuff to do, right? Support us. Support us in our work here. I've turned into a student again. But no, I mean, that, you know, that was a really a significant lesson. But then, you know, on the other side of it, in my personal life, you know, where I live at the top of the Otter Tail River, which goes to the Red River, and I live in an ecosystem that is also the top of the Mississippi. I live at the top of the watershed. I live where the wild things are. So when I go to my daughter's house, which is on the other side of the lake, you know, pretty soon we're just going to canoe back and forth across, or in my, you know, my next round, I think I might just have a tin can to call her because I'm so sick of the cell phone. Anyway, so I go there, and every time I go there, there's like two otters that live there. There's some swans. There's like one heron. And people ask me sometimes, who do you work for, Winona? You know, they don't ask me that too much, but I say, oh, I work for that heron. So what am I saying? Like, we get to live in a beautiful world. And so my faith in this world is, and my faith in my responsibility is reaffirmed when I get to see that which is so beautiful. And so see that which is beautiful, because that's why we are here in this relationship. And restore yourself. And then make sure that you go, you know, hang with your people, do some good dance, you know, have some good salmon. You know, make sure that you do that. And life is good then, you know. And you all know the same thing. Or, you know, one thing I noticed, I have a lot of PTSD from all those cops. I found that gardening really helped my PTSD. I don't know how else to say it, you know. But just go and do that. And I tell young people, a hoe is a garden tool. We got to remember that. That's what a hoe is, a garden tool. And so that helps. You know, all that stuff helps. Okay.
Of all the projects you have been a part of and started, which has been the most impactful and important to you?
All those projects, you know, that is just my life, you know. I get to work on all kind of cool things, and different things are super at different times, you know, and are absolutely important. But, you know, over the course of my life, I seen we put sturgeon back in our river, right? And I look over there, and it's like 25 years later, and those sturgeon are having babies, and they're like all over, and every once in a while someone says, I saw a sea monster in the lake. I was like, yeah, that's ours. Right, you know what I'm saying is, it's like, what are we doing here, right? Bring back some fish, watch some buffalo come home, swans came back to our territory, right? Buy back a lot of land. That was my therapy program from Enbridge. You know, we did the White Earth Land Recovery Project, and around 2013, I left them to go work on the Enbridge pipeline and buy another 1,000 acres of land now. I felt a lot better buying land, you know, seeing land go back for traditional ways and ceremonies, so... All those things, you know, important. But I feel like that maybe one of the best things is that I get to hang out with people like you. But anyway, you know, the fact that you can share an idea and someone takes that idea and it helps them. That's pretty cool too. Because we all share with each other, and that's how we, you know, get to feel bigger in our hearts. It's been a good journey so far. Maybe I get some more land back and grow more corn varieties and hemp, right? And then, you know, right now, I'm on the edge of the new green revolution. That's what we call it. Because the green revolution was not so good in the end. You know that, like a lot of bad stuff happened. But the new green revolution, hemp can transform the materials economy. The word canvas comes from cannabis, right? You can make housing, you can make paper. And so I get to be in the revolution. That sounds pretty fun, huh? So I ain't done yet. I ain't done yet with that party, and I'm going to continue on. So anyway, thank you so much.
You were just listening to Winona LaDuc, Rights of Nature, an Indigenous View. She spoke at the University of Oregon in Eugene in March 2025. Winona LaDuc, an Anishinaabe elder, is an articulate representative of Indigenous perspectives. She's the author of many books, including To Be a Water Protector. This program is produced by Alternative Radio. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Robin D.G. Kelly, Heather Cox Richardson, Russell Means, Gabor Mate, and Francesca Albanese. And we have a series of Winona LaDuke programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Winona LaDuke, Rights of Nature and Indigenous View, and for her book, To Be a Water Protector, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to Matt Laubach. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Robbie Robertson, Wandering Souls.
Now, opening the vaults on over 100 years of recorded music history. Welcome to Cruise in the Decades, Global Edition. One song per decade, 100 years of music in 1 hour. Produced and hand-selected by Brad Savage in the studios of WAPS-FM, The Summit, in Akron, Canton, Youngstown, Athens, Ohio, USA. Presented in this special global edition on the greatest independent radio stations across planet Earth on shortwave via the super-powered Radio Miami International, WRMI in Okeechobee, Florida. On Channel 292 shortwave from Rohrbach, Germany, heard across Europe and Northern Africa. And on the 500-kilowatt WBCQ The Planet in Monticello, Maine, on the Canadian border. On FM and AM via broadcast signals all across North America and planet Earth. Get ready to go cruising through 100 years of popular music. This is a journey through music history from someone with a rather ridiculous record collection. Here's your host for Cruising the Decades, Brad Savage. Brad Savage.
Ready, get set, go. Jump into the cruising time machine. We'll do one song per decade and 100 years of music. All styles welcome, all genres welcome. I'm Brad Savage. This is episode number 99. CruisingTheDecades.com. On today's show, None of Your Business with Butterbeans and Susie in 1927, plus a UK disco soul group from 1977 covers Ann Peebles. And the Dominoes, early 50s R&B, another very risque song in the early building blocks of rock and roll music. And the UK band, the Stone Roses, makes a big debut in 1989. But we'll begin with a little pomp and circumstance, circa 1911. This is an early recording of one of the most famous British patriotic songs of all time. It is sung by Dame Clara Butt, The song was written in 1901 by Edward Elgar. And you probably know it in America and around the world for graduation ceremonies and educational events. In Britain, it is often used at sporting events and other large gatherings of people. In America, we know the instrumental version mostly, but here's an early recording with lyrics, "The Land of Hope and Glory." Once again, this is Dame Clara Butt from 1911, and it's on Cruise in the Decades.